This is Ann Taylor, Jung's Post-Cardiac Visions, Image and Individuation. This is Ann Taylor, November 11, 2011, Jung's Post-Cardiac Visions, Image and Individuation. This was recorded on DVD. There were just a couple of images on this DVD. It's in the library at the Jung Society.
I'm happy to see all of you coming out tonight, and welcome to our presentation tonight. Our speaker tonight is Ann Taylor, and she's speaking on Jung's post-heart attack and visions. And Ann is a graduate of Pacifica, and she's been working on her PhD down there, and the title of her dissertation is Medical Humanities, Speaking to the Cardiologist Through Myth and Metaphor. Her professional background is in cardiology, chemistry, and hematology. She is also a certified Kundalini yoga instructor, and she has her studio on Kameno Island, which is where she lives. So we'll all welcome Anne tonight.
Well, thank you, Bunny, and thank you to all the members of the Jung Society and to everybody who's come out tonight on such a blustery evening. I appreciate it. The work I will present tonight resulted from an alchemical process combining my scientific background as a clinical chemist, EKG technician, and senior director of product development for a cardiac monitoring company, and my academic research infused with Kundalini yoga experience. This image that I have here depicts the different avenues that personally led me to an interest in the study of the human heart. Death from myocardial infarction and progressive coronary disease is still the number one killer for men and women in the United States and developed nations. The American Heart Association states that every 36 seconds, a person dies in the United States from heart disease, and 2,400 Americans die daily from heart disease. Not only is there a loss of life from heart disease, but also a psychical disease expressed as depression and a reduced will to live. The American Heart Association claims that the cost of treating heart disease will triple over the next 20 years, making our healthcare system even less sustainable than it is today. Lifestyle modifications are not enough to prevent heart disease. Emotional self-mastery is an essential component in the process of health. According to the Harvard Medical Family Health Guide, a depressed post-infarct patient is 2 to 3 times more likely to re-infarct than their non-depressed counterparts, and up to 50% of all heart attack survivors are indeed depressed. Furthermore, a post-MI depression differs from other forms of depression, chronic depression, in that it has post-traumatic stress qualities. The depression is rooted in fear and grief. Life will never be the same. The crisis of a heart attack leaves one with a deep sense of helplessness and vulnerability, fertile ground for an alchemical transformation. Cardiac patients are involuntarily plunged into an underground experience the moment the infarction seizes the heart, or is deliberately stopped during bypass in a godlike fashion. The cardiac survivor has smelled Dante's Inferno. The stench of death is imprinted on his or her memory. Cardiologists attend to the physical heart pump with accuracy and precision, whereas the depth psychologist opens up blockages leading to the imaginal heart, bringing new insight to the patient. The term imaginal is rooted in the Islamic tradition, which views the heart as the organ of perception. The heart serves as the hinge that can see into the here and now as well as transcendent reality. By descending into death, the alchemical blackened nigrita state, the patient is lost and faced with a choice. one may despair and circumvent the experience by relying exclusively on antidepressants or other numbing techniques, thereby missing the richness of the darkness. Or one may accept the wisdom of the guide, as Dante did with Virgil, and consciously acknowledge that the threshold into Hades has been crossed. The latter choice allows the patient to answer the hero's call by flowing with the descending journey instead of trying to avert it. In 1944, at the age of 69, Carl Jung experienced a massive heart attack, leaving him suspended between life and death. While in this liminal space of the bardo, that is somewhere between life and death, Jung had visions that would once again alter his life significantly. Joseph Campbell once famously said, "Myths are public dreams, and dreams are private myths." Jung found his personal myth through his profound visions during his period following his split with Freud, referred to in his semi-autobiographical work, Memories, Dreams, Reflections, as his confrontation with the unconscious. Jung reveals that, quote, "I understood that the self is the principle and archetype of orientation and meaning. Out of it emerged the first inkling of my personal myth," end quote. During this period, Jung treaded lightly between conscious and unconsciousness, interior worlds. Jung's unconscious mind loomed dark and wide and was in a perilous abyss into which he feared falling. Recognizing this, Jung deliberately anchored his psyche into a routine of work and family. Jung reflects, "It was most essential for me to have a normal life in the real world, as a counterpoise to the strange inner world. My family and my profession remained the base to which I always would return." Although Jung never fully succumbed to the undertow of the unconscious, he had tasted the dangers within. From the depths of his early underworld experience, Jung brought forth the seeds, the images that serve as the foundation for the collected works. Jung contends that it was the images were the prima materia for a lifetime of work. Jung returned to firm psychic ground with the realization of the centrality of the self, an outcome of his extensive work with mandala images. The recently published Red Book chronicles Jung's epic journey to the center as the self and shares the images captured during his numinous experiences with the unconscious. It was the secret of the golden flower that crystallized Jung's thinking. Jung asserts that the text of The Secret of the Golden Flower first put me in the right direction of the right track, for we have in the medieval alchemy the long sought after connecting link between gnosis and the processes of the collective unconscious. So if at the end of Jung's early traumatic visions, in which the Red Book was produced, ultimately, when he really started to bring it all together, the last image was the yellow mandala. And that was, that just coincided, the synchrony was that's when Richard Wilhelm sent him the copy of The Secret of the Golden Flower. And it ended that dark period. And he knew that he had the confirmation he needed that he was now moving in the right direction. Shyam Dasani identifies Jung's commentary of The Secret of the Golden Flower as a turning point. It was his first public discussion of the significance of the mandala. Wilhelm requested that Jung develop a psychological commentary to be included with the forthcoming English translation. Jung shares the synchronicity of the completion of the Golden Castle mandala, possessing a distinctive Chinese overtone. This is not the actual print. It's an image just to work with in your mind. Jung comments, "The text gave me an undreamed of confirmation of my ideas about the mandala and the circumnavigation of the center." So this is the point where he comes out of his struggles with the unconscious. Filled with alchemical symbolism, The golden flower provided Jung with a link between his visions and the collective unconscious, vital to his psychological recovery and trajectory of his work. Through the ancient Tao text, Jung was provided with much-needed validation for his emerging direction into alchemy. Biographer Deidre Baird asserts that alchemy was the missing link with Jung and his study of archetypes in the collective unconscious. For Jung, individuation was the alchemical process of turning the base metal of the lower ego into gold, revealing the self. Jung states, "Light on the nature of alchemy became to come to me only after I had read the text of the golden flower, that specimen of Chinese alchemy which Richard Wilhelm sent to me." Where the Red Book gives us insight into the early phases of Jung's individuation process, the Heart Attack Visions of 1944 allows us to witness the fulfillment of Jung's individuation process. Baer wrote of Jung's visions as, quote, "These visions of 1944, the most enormous experience he had ever had or would be likely to have in the remaining years of his life," end quote. The value in exploring Jung's heart attack visions through an archetypal and alchemical lens is to inform the cardiac patient that a heart attack may provide a vital opening into his or her psyche, perhaps for the first time in a meaningful way. Through a Jungian perspective, the images are approached as dream images, which allow the archetypal symbolism to expand into Jung's own association on his writings. And I'd just like to qualify, you know, the work that I'm doing came out of memories, dreams, and reflections. You know, obviously I don't know what Jung was thinking with these, but by looking at past writings, I'm approaching them as a dream. Jung's life-threatening heart attack exemplifies the hero's journey par excellence. By 1944, Jung had produced many impressive volumes of work. However, his most self-proclaimed significant publication was yet to emerge. Jung's heart attack vision and subsequent three-week engagement with his nightly visions allowed him to re-engage with the world and produce, quote, "a fruitful period of work." So I think that this is just amazing. At the age of 69, his most important works are yet to come forward, so that's encouraging to the rest of us, too. Jung writes in Memories, Dreams, Reflections, "A good many of my principal works were written only after then, post-heart attack. Mysterium Cuniciatus is the crowning achievement in Jung's opus, taking over a decade to complete," thank you, "and being substantially completed post-infarct. If the commentary to The Secret of the Golden Flower was Jung's initial alchemical writing, then Mysterium Cuniciatus was his final account of his lengthy researches into alchemy." Were Carl Jung's heart attack visions unique, or is there potential for the cardiac patient as well? Visions may be worked as dreams, and dreams as visions. It is critical that the cardiac patient nurture images as they arise post-infarct and journals his or her own emotional responses, as well as imagining details through creative works or drawings. Even though the cardiac patient may not understand the symbolic messages coming forward, it is essential to harvest the prima materia as it emerges. Jung emphasized the importance of the images when he wrote, "I took great care to understand every single image, every item of my psychic inventory, and to classify them scientifically, so far as that was possible, and above all, to realize them in actual life. This is what we usually neglect to do. We allow the images to rise up. We maybe even wonder about them for a while, but that is all," end quote. The images that arise during the cardiac patient's initial phase of recovery are vital indicators of his or her own psychological state. It is critically important to collect and preserve emerging images. Within the trauma of sudden cardiac arrest lies an opportunity for the cardiac patient's psyche that is too valuable to bypass. In Puer Wounds and Ulysses Scar, James Hillman contends that each organ has a potential spark of consciousness, and afflictions release that consciousness, bringing to awareness the organ's archetypal background, which until wounded had simply functioned physiologically as an part of unconscious nature. So that's a tremendous statement, that the organs, all the parts of the body, they go on and heart beats continuously. We're not aware of it. When it's wounded, the consciousness is released. Depth psychology augments the scientific pursuit of healing with insights into disease and its effects upon the human psyche. The psychological complex is exposed through the wound, the arrested heart. The wound hits psyche's nerve, thus potentially exposing one's archetypal complex, now available to the conscious mind. A heart attack may be thought as an initiatory event. The heretofore unconscious rhythmic pattern suddenly takes center stage in one's psyche. Through the wounded heart, the patient is given an opportunity to enter archetypal consciousness, a valuable entry point into the individuation process. Although the opportunity for increased consciousness may not initially be apparent to the cardiac patient, it may emerge with the help of the depth psychologist. Tonight's presentation focuses on a depth psychological approach to sudden cardiac arrest and acute myocardial infarction, and searches for sampling of images that emerge from Jung's psyche during and after his heart attack. In The Golden Flower, he contended that the gods have become our diseases. Zeus no longer rules Olympus, but rather the solar plexus, and produces curious specimens for the doctor's room, end quote. If one accepts Jung's premise that the gods have become our diseases, then each patient has a unique constellation of psychological complexes, the gods, contributing to his or her own disease state. When exploring mythology, the cardiac patient may benefit by reflecting on which gods or goddesses resonate most profoundly with his or her own psyche. Through the patient's imagination, guided by the counselor, the depth psychologist, the archetypal implications of symptoms may be evoked. Hillman stresses, lose the symptom and return the world back to the ego. So what we often do, of course, the cardiologists and the medical system want to get the patient well. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But let us not be too quickly to lose the symptom where the alchemical gold really lies. In other words, the ego steps aside during trauma and a heart attack where it has no control, thus providing the psyche an opportunity to expand into new territory. I just would like to say a word about approaching images and a term that Carl Jung himself used, betrachten. And I like that term because he says that the term translates to make pregnant. Something is due to come alive. And Jung contends that looking at the image makes it pregnant with meaning. So Jung observed, quote, that in case with fantasy image, one concentrates upon it and then finds one has great difficulty in keeping the thing quiet. It gets restless, it shifts, something is added, or it multiplies, or it fills with living power, and it becomes pregnant. Looking deeply into the image of the sea, the image of the unconscious, fosters the appearance of the object. The object becomes restless, it morphs, changes, and something wants to emerge to be born. That looking, psychologically, brings about the activation of the object. To open one's heart and enter into the imaginal realm is to see the heart as more than a blood-pumping organ. One begins to see with the eyes of the heart, the organ of perception. Henri Corbin's term and concept of mundus imaginalis is foundational to depth psychology. Corbin distinguishes the term imaginal, derived from Latin imaginalis, from imaginary, which implies being not real or made up, having some fantasy quality. One of the comments that struck me about what Jung said about his own heart attack visions is he really emphasizes, quote, the visions and experiences were utterly real. There was nothing subjective about them, end quote. Corbin retrieves imaginal thinking for Westerners, whose imaginal thinking has become grossly depleted. Despite the bombardment of images coming at us all day long through the internet, media, one seldom engages with the images in a deep and powerful way. As the postmodern human processes copious data, seldom does one distill wisdom from the heart through techniques designed to engage with images. I concur with Hillman when he states that, quote, we are bereft in our culture of an adequate psychology and philosophy of the heart, and therefore also of imagination. Through a Jungian perspective, the images are approached as dreams, as I mentioned, which allow the archetypal symbolism to expand. And the first image from the actual visions chapter of Memories, Dreams, and Reflections is the vision of Earth. One of the words he uses here is a luminous expression of the color blue. It's his term is very uplifting. It's a expanded state of consciousness. Okay, as he looked down, he noted the colors of the deep blue oceans and the continents. From the perspective looking at, he distinctly saw India and Sri Lanka. And combining, connecting the two, there is Rama's bridge. I thought it was very interesting that this was the first vision that Jung saw of the earth as he's withdrawing his consciousness. Because of his deep love for the Eastern traditions, this is where this was his first perspective. Now, bearing in mind that the NASA photographs didn't come out for another, like, 69, for decades later, so that Jung's out-of-body experience, I'm not sure what you could call it, his description, he must have been 1,000 miles up off the ground. He also made note that he didn't see the whole Earth at one time. He saw portions of it. And so from a perspective, he's withdrawing consciousness from the Earth, from the collective conscious. And then he noted that as he turned to the left, he saw the reds of Saudi Arabia, which was called at that time. And I see this as an alchemical transformation in his visions. First, we're seeing the blues, and it's very sublime. And now we're transitioning into the red tones. He also noted that he could see the snow-capped Himalaya mountains in the distance. And the other comment, which I find interesting, and it's the type of thing you think about for a while and see what emerges in your own mind, but he said he did not look to the right. So that could play so many different ways, from a yogic expression, or the right side of the body is the masculine, the sun energy. He kept his focus center, and then to the left. He noted colors of green as he's pulling away, and a softness and a lightness. Okay, the next, this is a very important segment in the, he first pulls away his consciousness from the earth. He's removed himself from the collective whole. And then he, the first thing that comes onto his vision is a meteorite. And I just would like to start this segment with a quote from Henri Corbin, who says, "The temple must first be built in the heart." I think that sums up this portion very nicely. As happens in dreams, Jung's vision shifts abruptly. A short distance away, I saw a space, a tremendous dark block of stone like a meteorite. It was about the size of my house or even bigger. Although an entire study could be dedicated to Jung's archetypal association with stones, I mention a few key examples here. As a child, the large square blocks of stone in an old garden wall fascinated Jung, and he often sat upon them. Jung recalls his unique association with stones in memories, dreams, and reflections. As he mused, "Am I the one sitting on the stone and it underneath me?" Jung unknowingly engages in active imagination when the stone responds. "Or am I the stone on which he is sitting?" From his early days, Jung views stones as more than inert objects, possessing something hidden or secret deep within. As a schoolboy, Jung carved the top of his ruler into a mannequin, which he named Philemon, which you all know, and supplied him with a painted stone delineated into upper and lower halves. The image presages Jung's later theory of consciousness and unconscious aspects of the human psyche. Bare quotes from Jung from the unpublished and uncirculated document Protocols, quote, "Later when I read Greek, I discovered when Zeus was troubled in love, he would go sit down on a stone. In my case, it was not a question of troubled love, but of who I really was," end quote. Jung's identity, his self, was metaphorically hidden in the stone. An alchemical process of individuation was required to release the captured self. Jung's vision of the stone as an image of the sacred self opens the following description. An entrance led to a small antechamber. So we start with the meteorite, and then the image is morphing in his vision into the beginnings of a temple. To the right of the entrance, a black Hindu sat in the lotus position on a stone bench. He wore a small white gown, and I know that he expected me. Mysterious Connunciatus, a post-cardiac work, provides significant insight into Jung's perspective on stone symbolism, which fosters largely into his alchemical perspectives. Jung's alchemical studies were derived in part from the works of Gerhard Dorn, a 16th century alchemist. In the conjunction, Jung wrote, Dorn's kalium, which corresponded to the stone, was on the one hand a liquid blue that could be poured out of a bottle, and on the other, the microcosm itself. For the psychologist, it is the self, man as he is, and is indescribable and super empirical totality of the same man. In Jung's same essay published in Mysterium Connunciatus, Jung describes kalium as heavenly substance containing all distinct forms and simultaneously the ultimate universal form. It symbolizes a prefiguration of the soul. The kalium and its function in alchemy, as inviting as they are, provide an avenue for further study. Jung further contended in the same essay that man himself is partly empirical, partly transcendental. He, too, is a stone that is no stone. A stone that is no stone reflects Jung's earlier experience with active imagination. From this perspective, the consciousness lies within the stone. Corbin uses the image of a pearl held within the black rock as an archetypal equivalent to the stone that is not a stone. The human parallel implies that consciousness lies within the human body and that the human heart is more than a blood pump. In Jung's vision, the yogi sits in a lotus position on the stone. With contemplation, the spiritual seeker purifies his or her own heart, thereby concentrating the power of the heart to reflect the divine. And from Corbin's viewpoint, he called that Hima. And again, I bring up Corbin because he was so influential on James Hillman when Hillman wrote The Thought of the Heart and the Soul of the World, which is a fantastic book, but it really is all predicated on Corbin's initial work. From the concentrated power of the heart, the temple emerges. The inside turns outward, and several months ago, Tom Cheatham was here, for those of you who had the pleasure of hearing him. Tom Cheatham's book is based on the work of Henri Corbin, The World Turned Inside Out, explores this Islamic mystical concept in detail. Jung's imagination projects the image of the temple outward, an image he approaches with awe and reverence. From a depth psychological perspective, Corbin contends that such a form or image is needed for the psyche to grasp the concept of imago templi, the sacred temple within. Corbin asserts that, I would say that the virtue of the imago templi lies in making us be within ourselves, outside ourselves. So if you just think a second, that's Jung is outside the temple, and the work is, the vision is actually going on inside of him. For we must not confuse introspection, introversion, and contemplation. There is no contemplation without the temple. Corbin's comments summarize the archetypal experience with the temple, which Jung experienced firsthand. This theory involves rupturing the notion of self and other as subjective and brings oneself into pure objective form, which will be important in a few moments. To enter the temple is to melt object and subject together. From outside the temple, Jung recalls, I existed in objective form. I was what I had been and lived. Jung experienced the withdrawal of his ego during the painful defoliation, and what remained was Jung's self. I had everything that I was, and that was everything. Jung was experiencing his pure essence, devoid of ego. Jung's vision occurs in the imaginal realm of Corbin's Mundus Imaginalis, comparable to the realm of the in-between, the Islamic concept of Barzakh. And the Tantra concept of the Bardo from Tibetan Buddhism. Said another way, this is the realm between two seas of consciousness. So the leaf is just symbolizing what's happening here. He's continuing on his process. Jung did not see the temple with his physical eyes. Rather, this vision was apprehended through the eyes of his heart in the imaginal realm. Because at this point in the visions, Jung is literally on the table with his heart stopped. He's in full cardiac arrest. Carl Jung had stepped into the Bardo, or Barzakh, during this heart attack and saw with the organ of perception, the heart. I agree with Hillman when he asserts that this imaginal intelligence resides in the heart. Intelligence of the heart connotates simultaneously knowing by means of imagining. This form of knowing imaginally is not subject to the same laws of reason. Jung's vision of the temple reveals further significant psychological elements. What began in the vision as a large stone block morphs into a sacred temple. Jung excitedly anticipates entering the temple, knowing that what is expected. Okay, one more, please. The yogi silently meditates while waiting for Jung's arrival. Jung perceives that all his questions regarding the mysteries of life are about to be disclosed to him. From Jung's eager anticipation, one may conclude that great wisdom is to be found inside the temple, that which has been previously unknown. From the Sufi perspective, Corbin writes, the Imago Templi is associated particularly with the representation of wisdom, Sophia, a hypostasis common in wisdom literature, end quote. In Jung's pre-cardiac work, The Symbolism of the Mandala, he includes a 17th century plate, which describes the temple of the wise held within a mountain buried deep. Jung describes the door to the temple as having a wreath of bright flames and recalls having seen such a sight in real life at the Temple of the Holy Tooth in Ceylon. In the well-known image of the dancing Shiva, a ring of flames encircles Shiva, symbolizing the element of fire that one must pass through for purification and transformation. So when we started with the earth element, and Jung was very, very familiar with Kundalini yoga, he associates that with Mulahara, the root chakra. So now and the earth, the water, we're moving up to the second. And now with the third, you know, we're at the solar plexus. So he's transitioning in many, many levels here. Jung wrote, the Buddhist mandalas, consist of a circular padma or lotus which contains a square sacred building. The center contains a Buddha, or more often the conjunction of Shiva and Shakti. They are yantras for contemplation, concentration, and the final transformation of the yogin's consciousness into the all-divine consciousness, end quote. Eastern temples are effectively three-dimensional yantras, a tantric meditation tool. So the yantra is like a small device used for meditation, but the buildings are physical yantras, mandalas in architectural form. By approaching an elementary understanding of a yantra, one gains insight into the archetypal significance of the Eastern temple as well. A temple is an architectural adaptation of a yantra and may be thought of as a blueprint for the tantra. Madhu Khanna contends that, quote, the relationship of a yantra and architecture is especially close in moments which may be called mandalas of stone. So I'm trying to tie together different pieces that would have been important throughout Jung's life and bring them together as, you know, we don't really know what his vision looked like to him. We have it described in Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Essentially, Jung's vision of the temple was a spontaneous psychical emission of the mandala in stone form. The temple is an archetypal image which spans across divergent mythologies and theologies. Although expressed image is unique among various traditions, the underlying archetype serves as a mythogem, a universal component that communicates the same primary message. For example, Jung's stone block is archetypally similar to the Islamic temple. Corbin expresses it like this, quote, the temple on earth corresponds to the temple in the fourth heaven, and it is square in form because the worlds on which Islam is founded are four in number. So in other words, they're just scalable within the psyche. Jung's underlying quaternity is inherent in the symbol of the temple, whereas Eastern, or whether it be Eastern or Islamic form. Jung's quaternity is deeply embedded in his psyche, as well as the Eastern mandala forms. Although the phenomenological forms of Jung's envisioned temple and Corbin's temple may be different, the underlying archetypal structures serve similar psychic functions. Regarding the symbolism of the mandala, Jung asserted in Symbolism of the Mandala that, quote, the center is nothing but a point at which the psyche ceases to be knowable because that's where it coalesces with the body, end quote. The center or bindu point reflects multiplicity united or collapsed. So at the very center of the mandala, that would be the equivalent of the self. It's the point of unity. Jung's temple vision included the threshold guardian, the seated meditating yogi on the stone. Corbin writes, he, the angel Gabriel, stands, as we know, at the temple threshold, close to the corner in which the black stone is embedded. So there's guardians and protectors to protect the sacred space that's within the temple. Inside the temple lies revealed mystery and wisdom, which is what Jung was anticipating, which must be guarded from ignorant, much as Emma guarded the vulnerable Jung during his own recovery time in the hospital stay from gossip, from ignorant townspeople and colleagues' gossip. Jung's vision and interaction with the temple exemplifies what Corbin called active imagination in its full manifestation. Although Jung lies unconscious in his hospital bed, his psyche is in full operation. Thus, one may conclude that all the images are generated from Jung's unconscious mind, from a Jungian perspective. Hima, as previously discussed, is the concentrated power and imaginative faculties of the heart. Hillman has coined the term the thought of the heart as Hima, which creates as real the figures of imagination. The angels, the daemons, who, as Corbin says, are outside the imagining faculty. Despite the fact that Jung's physical heart is attacking, his imaginal heart has opened wide through the wounding process as he projects the temple onto an outward reality. Andre Rodriguez, who's a scholar of the poet John Keats, writing quite independently of Jung's vision, writes, quote, Keats saw the temple with his eyes of imagination, the eyes of the inner vision. Keats' theme in the Penetralium helps to further illumine Jung's vision of the temple. Both the theme and the vision express the deep inner recesses where truth resides. Jung asserted, I felt certain that I would receive all the questions as soon as I entered the temple. He's in full anticipation at this point. So Jung was on the cusp of penetrating the temple when his vision again abruptly changed. From below, this is Jung's words, from below, from the direction of Europe, an image floated up. It was my Dr. H, or rather his likeness, framed by a golden chain or golden laurel wreath. I knew at once, aha, this is my doctor. But now he is coming to me in his primal form, as the Basilius of Kos. In life, he was an avatar of this Basilius, the temporal embodiment of primal form, which has existed from the beginning. Now he is appearing in his primal form. So now we're shifting from the temple vision to the wise old man of his H coming up. During Jung's vision, Dr. H advises him that there is great objection to his leaving Earth, a protest that goes beyond the limits of grief surrounding one's impending death. Dr. H informed Jung that, quote, he had been delegated by Earth to protest against his going away, end of quote. Jung's unconscious mind perceived that he was not entitled to leave because his work on the Earth was not complete. Although Jung was on the threshold of the temple, he abruptly felt himself being pulled back into his physical body. This turning point in Jung's vision is critical because it exemplifies Jung's concept of synchronicity and destiny, as will be discussed shortly. In the Divine Comedy, Dante's vision of Beatrice, his anima, is replaced at the threshold of paradise by the wise old man archetype, Saint Bernard. Likewise, Jung's use of the term anima, earth symbology previously discussed, is replaced by the wise old man archetype framed with the golden wreath, his Dr. H. Archetypally, Jung's heart surgeon appeared in the vision representing the wise old man. The doctor appeared to Jung as Basileus of Kos, that is, the king of the Greek island of Kos, the site of Asclepius' temple and birthplace of Hippocrates. Jung's higher intuition generated by the appearance of the self, the wise old man, asserted that Jung's destiny was incomplete and he must return to complete his work. In a letter to Alice Raphael in 1955, 11 years post-infarct, Jung wrote, Philemon, the loving one, the simple old loving couple, close to the earth and aware of the gods, the complete opposite of the Superman Faust, the product of the devil. Incidentally, in my tower at Bollingen is a hidden inscription which translates to Philemon's sanctuary, Faust's repentance. When I first encountered the archetype of the wise old man, he called himself Philemon. So again, I'm just bringing in some of what Jung said himself about the wise old man so we can start to piece together some of what he's experiencing. By exploring recurring images from Jungian perspective, the human psyche engages with its destiny. Jung recalls, from the beginning, I had a sense of destiny, as though my life were assigned to me by a fate and had to be fulfilled. This gave me an inner security, and though I could never prove it to myself, it proved itself to me. I did not have the certainty, it had me. Psychic states of destiny and synchronicity are outside the bounds of empirical proof, yet Jung had a sense of certainty regarding these matters. So he does believe that his destiny was not fulfilled and he did have to return back to Earth. The ancient Taoist text, the I Ching, precedes Jung's concept of synchronicity and destiny by millennia, and recognizes the guiding principle, the Tao, that is larger than one's egoic will. The Tao emanates from one's heart, although most humans do not live silently enough to hear it. Wilhelm translates, the human heart is the germ of the way. So the heart and the Tao are linked very closely. If you can be absolutely quiet, then the human heart will spontaneously manifest it, meaning the Tao. This thinking parallels the Sufis' notion of prayer and meditation as a way to polish the heart, polishing the rust off the heart, so that it may reflect the divine. In Jung's vision, Dr. H, as Basileus of Kos, appeared to communicate the urgent protest against Jung's departure from Earth. Furthermore, it was silently communicated that he had no right and must return. The vision stopped at once, and Jung sadly found himself back in the hospital bed. Okay, just out of curiosity, how many people have read Memories, Dreams, and Reflections? And okay, so most people have read through the visions before. Unable to convince himself that life was worth living in the box system, as he called it. where everyone lives in his or her own separate reality. Jung lamented, "I was profoundly disappointed, for now it seemed that it had all been for nothing. The painful process of defoliation had been in vain, and I was not allowed to enter the temple to join the people in whose company I belonged." End quote. Defoliation is a process of letting go, separating from earthly possessions, including one's own ego and persona. To strip away the masks, covering oneself is to be left painfully exposed to the scrutiny of others and one's own ego self-image. Jung recalled his anguish. "I had been so glad to shed it all, and now I had to come back to it, along with everyone else, and would be hung up in a box by a thread." Jung's deep depression followed his heart attack, and this is a common post-cardiac phenomena, as I mentioned at the beginning, and places patients at increased risk for future attacks. Jung was back in the underworld after his heart attack and quite uncertain whether he wanted to live. Reflecting in his later years, he recalled, "In reality, it was a good 3 weeks that still was to pass before I could truly make up my mind to live again." And as I mentioned earlier, a patient is up to 4 times more likely to incur a subsequent heart attack if there's significant depression. Jung's wife, Emma, closely monitored Jung's hospital visit during that time. And Jung became very upset with his doctor because he was seeing him in his vision as Basilius of Kos. And the doctor, you know, of course, thought he was probably losing his mind at this point. And Emma had to actually, you know, protect him from visitors. And Emma agreed Jung to be more agreeable with his doctor, or Jung's behavior would be perceived as delirium. But Jung urged Dr. H to take better care of himself, and his warnings went unheeded. Although Jung was furious with Dr. H for summoning him back to Earth, he also feared for the doctor's life. His intuition was that since Dr. H had appeared to him in his primal form as Basilius of Kos, the doctor would have to die in his place. Okay, the next series. Next slide. "During those weeks, I lived in a strange pattern," Jung recalls. "By day, I was usually very depressed. Towards evening," and this is from the MDR, "toward evening, I would fall asleep, and my sleep would last till about midnight. Then I would come to myself and lie awake for about an hour. This was eternal bliss. This cannot be described. This is far too wonderful. But in an utterly transformed state, it was as if I was in ecstasy." So Jung enters a numinous state every night where beauty and unity are intoxicating his whole being. He recalls, "I felt as though I were floating in space, as though I were safe in the womb of the universe, in a tremendous void." He had a housekeeper or a woman in the house, but he actually envisioned her as much older than she actually was. "At this hour of midnight, the night nurse brought me some food, which she had warmed." And up to this point, he couldn't eat anything. During the day, he had zero appetite. "For only then I was able to take any, and I ate with appetite. For a time to me, it seemed that she was an old Jewish woman, much older than she actually was, and she was preparing a ritual kosher dishes for me. She seemed to have a blue halo around her head." So he's entering into another phase of visions where his nurse is suddenly taking on this sacred quality, wise old woman may be some of the archetypal themes. I myself, or so it seemed, was in the Garden of Pomegranates. So now he's into a Jewish theme, which people have written, you know, extensively on, but I'm not going to go down in that particular direction. Okay. And he's also then imagining the wedding of Tiphereth with Malkuth was taking place. So that's from the Kabbalah. Or else I was Rabbi Ben Jachai, and excuse me if I'm mispronouncing that, whose wedding in the afterlife was actually being celebrated. So now this, who he's referring to is the author of the Zohar, so the ancient sacred text. Jung is going into a very numinous state of mind during these visions. At the bottom of it, this was him, I myself. I was the marriage, and my beatitude was that of the blissful wedding. The marriage of the Lamb is another image that comes to him. The All-Father Zeus consummating the mystic marriage. So from this perspective, he is, from my perspective, I guess, he is actually now entering the temple. The divine marriages are taking place. Night after night, I floated in a state of purest bliss, thronged round with images of creation. So now again, he wakes up in the morning, and as it is when one enters into spiritual beauty, it's difficult to hold that, impossible, perhaps. The gray morning represents the shadow side of Jung's individuation process. In 1932, Jung remarks on one of Christina Morgan's visions when he says, quote, "The cloud had descended. The blackness had revealed itself. This is the shadow of individuation. On the one side, the liberation and the synthesis of a superior being, and on the other side, that terrible shadow, the sacrifice of the personal earthly being," end quote. So this is what Jung's experiencing, and that was his own writing from the 30s, the shadow side of individuation. Jung recalls, "It is impossible to convey the beauty and intensity of emotion during those visions. They were the most tremendous things I had ever experienced." Jung was tormented by the juxtaposition of his nightly visions of ecstasy against the dull gray isolation of the daylight hours. Although Jung gradually returns to his belief in the world, he maintains the impression that this life is a segment of existence which is enacted in a three-dimensional, box-like universe, especially set up for it. And quote, "This life is a segment of existence which is enacted in a three-dimensional, box-like universe, especially set up for it." Yeah, some powerful stuff. So Jung is seeing his daylight hours as an imprisonment. To enter the temple, as in the earlier vision, Jung would have had to die at some level. Quote, "For me, the presence of sanctity had a magical atmosphere. I feared it might be unendurable to others. I understood then why one speaks of the odor of sanctity, of the sweet smell of the Holy Ghost. That was it," end of quote. So he's going through different traditions, obviously, and the divine union producing Christ consciousness. Jung has now entered the temple, quote unquote, "those people to whom I belong to in reality." So he's seeing himself in these mystical unions, that is actually the process that's occurring in him. His individuation is being fulfilled. From a Christian mythos perspective, the divine virginal union between Mary and Joseph produces the Christ child, a third independent entity. Jung speaks of the Christian perspective as a psychological projection that, quote, the leading idea of a new religion following the Christian age would be that everyone would be Christ, that Christ had been merely the projection of the entirety of human mystery, end quote. So in this case, Jung is taking back projections and that divine marriage is happening within his own psyche. There was a pneuma of inexpressible sanctity in the room, whose manifestation was the Mysterium Coenunciatus. The objectivity which I experienced in the dream and in the visions is part of a completed individuation. It signifies detachment from valuations and from what we call emotional ties. So we're actually getting a window into Jung's own individuation process, you know, forming. Not that one ever completes it 100%, but I think it's safe to say it's fulfilled. Jung describes the experience as, quote, the ecstasy of a non-temporal state in which the past, present, and future are one. So I just want to take a moment, that concept of time becoming one, past, present, future. The god Kairos presents himself as opportunity, that which must be grabbed at the precise moment. The tuft of hair springs from Kairos's forehead. The back of his head's bald. And once he's passed, there's nothing to grab onto. The opportunity has been lost. The heart attack opens the portal to the psyche by breaking through ordinary chronological or Cronus time and allows one to glimpse time eternal. And I believe that's what Jung was just expressing. The British literary critic Frank Kermode's definition posits the Kairos is a point in time filled with significance, charged with meaning derived from its relation to the end. The heart attack is a life-altering episode that directly impacts the relationship to the end of one's life. Kairos jolts one out of complacency, created by mind-numbing routines, and provide fresh tracks of thought revealed through imagination. Jung's early work was a foreshadowing, a roadmap to his own individuation process, now in its completing phases. But Jung cautions, quote, but when one follows the path of individuation, when one lives one's own life, one must take mistakes into the bargain. Life would not be complete without them. There is no guarantee, not for a single moment, that we would not fall into error or stumble into deadly peril, end quote. Jung survives his heart attack and recovers from his intense depressive bout in a transformed way. Anyone who takes the sure road is as good as dead. That follows, that's what Jung is saying after that. Just because that there may be individuation process may kill you at some level. If you take the sure road in life where you know you're going to be safe, it's not a life worth living. After Jung's recovery, the integration of these visions, he concludes that, quote, it was only after the illness that I understood how important it is to affirm one's own destiny. So this is like the real jewels of the whole thing. This is what he's really finding to be important, his destiny, affirming my destiny. In this way, we forge an ego that does not break down when incomprehensible things happen, an ego that endures the truth, and that is capable of coping with the world and with fate, end quote. As in all hero journey experiences, the surviving patient has the option to answer the call or not. And Joseph Campbell urged, quote, we must let go of the life We have planned so we can accept the one that is waiting for us, end quote. By exploring Jung's heart attack visions, the cardiac patient may also tap into his or her own dream material. This allows one's own personal mythology to emerge from psyche. A heart attack brings a man or woman close to death. The juxtaposition between death and beauty enhances both, the beauty of life and the terror of death. Death holds freedom, which brings meaning into life. Just as in the myth with Psyche and Eros, Psyche's beauty is even more powerful than Aphrodite's because of her proximity to death. In other words, it's Psyche's mortality that intensifies her fleeting beauty. Mortality brings with it a more urgent call to find meaning in one's life. From the moment of birth, death is one's continual companion. And through this recognition, one has the choice to embrace life of meaning or sidestep mortality. Death creates urgency to follow one's own destiny and avoid entry into what T.S. Eliot calls the wasteland, that is, a life devoid of meaning and purpose. In Jung's later years, he concluded that, quote, meaning makes a great many things possible, endurable, perhaps everything. No science will ever replace myth, and a myth will never be made out of any science. The heart attack also provides an invitation to reintroduce meaning into one's life. The cardiac patient may experience a life renewed with meaning, not merely a life as it was lived before, but a transformed life. One is called to discern what's most important in life and live his or her truth. So, psychology viewpoint, we're not looking to get the patient to a state before the heart attack. We're looking for this as an opportunity to transform psyche and soul. The patient has crossed over the threshold of death the moment his or her heart stops, and the opportunity to turn about in the deepest seat of consciousness, that's a Tibetan concept, presents itself. The patient's vulnerability blossoms upon realizing that one's ego does not have the final say in the outcome of one's disease state. Through this vulnerable spot emerges an opportunity for individuation. By consciously stepping into the bardo, or gap, the patient may gain valuable transformative and generative insights. On April 4th, 1944, Jung sat on the edge of his bed for the first time after his heart attack. And on the same day, Dr. H took to his hospital bed and died of septicemia. Jung had tried to warn his doctor that he was in danger because he saw him in his primal form. In fact, Carl Jung was Dr. H's last patient. Think about today. Once synchronicities are occurring in your life right now, be open to the possibilities. According to the Kundalini Yoga tradition that I practice as taught by Yogi Bhajan, this marks the beginning of the Aquarian Age. As we move out of the Piscean Age and into the Aquarian Age, the quantum notion of coherence will begin to permeate our understanding of wholeness, psychological, physical, and spiritual. So this is a bit of a lead-up for tomorrow, because tomorrow what I'll be doing a little bit different, and looking at heart coherence, an integrative approach with depth psychology, you know, Jungian work, neurocardiology, which will be primarily heart rate variability, and Kundalini yoga. So, and there'll be also some meditations we do to actually facilitate. And I will have two heart rate variability monitors here so people can actually hook themselves up, do different breathing techniques. The heart rate variability provides a window into the autonomic nervous system. If you're not familiar with it, it's quite fascinating. And So at this point, I will open it up for not only questions, discussion, to get a little bit of discussion going around this topic.
And that is the end of the recording. This recording was made on DVD, and it included some images. The DVD is available in the library at the C.G. Jung Society, Seattle. The copyright is C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.